proposing marriage.
Explain yourself, Charlotte said. As I foresee the life of a spinster, I'll have independent means, freedom to occupy myself however I choose, and...
And the freedom to discreetly aid those most in need of assistance. Charlotte couldn't say that, of course. She didn't admit of those activities to even her family. Sherborne poured a cup of tea.
Freedom and independence. Do go on.
I'll also have a lively and interesting circle of friends.
Aunt Arabella had had that, though she'd been a widow rather than a spinster before joining the herd of Wyndhams thundering up the church aisle this year. Sherborne added milk and sugar, stirred the tea and passed it to her.
Your independent means, he said, will likely be a charitable trust arranged by your papa, brothers-in-law, or your uncle. Those funds will be controlled by the trustees of their choice, not yours. And once your male relatives are gone, you will be completely at the mercy of the trustees.
Was that how it worked? Charlotte was not much interested in legal matters, but she would ask a cousin who had read law, for controlling her own money mattered. Having a husband oversee my expenditures is preferable?
Your settlements will spell out which funds remain under your exclusive control as pin money, and will provide that should you be widowed, you and you alone will manage your finances. One item I have in adequate supply is coin.
One item you lack is delicacy, Mr. Sherborne.
This cup of tea was not as hot as Charlotte preferred, but it was fortifying and perfectly sweet.
Precisely. I lack delicacy, which is why you should marry me.
His command of a tea service was excellent. His shoulders were broad. His logic eluded her.
I'm to subject myself to a husband's supervision rather than be pitied for failing to secure any spouse at all.
Sherborne set the teapot down rather too hard on the tray.
Nobody would dare pity you.
Charlotte wanted to believe him, but too many tittering, gossiping, spiteful conversations prevented her. He did not pity her, and that meant more than it should.
All spinsters are pitied, Mr. Sherborne. We're supposed to pine away for lack of children to wait upon or a husband to serve, when in fact our greater sorrow is that we could become a burden on the parish.
Many married women have no children and see little of their spouses, but I hope our union would be fruitful. I like children, and think you'd make a marvellous mother.
How casually he flung compliments at her.
Why?
Because you are fierce. Your children would be fierce, and if they're to help shape the future of a realm threatened by a profligate imbecile on the throne, they'll need to be fierce.
The destruction of the entire nation didn't concern Charlotte. She was focused instead on lives left in tatters, thanks to heedless young men. She liked that Britain's fate concerned Sherborne, though, even if his politics were the nearest thing to blaspheming under Uncle Percival's roof.
You see us married and filling the nursery, Mr. Sherborne, when I have yet to consent to even a courtship.
He held up the plate of tea-cakes for her.
Would you like to be courted?
Charlotte chose a cake draped in orange glaze and tried to focus on the question rather than on the lazy heat in Sherborne's blue eyes. He'd kissed her passionately, with the door open and the house full of servants. How would he kiss late at night, tucked beneath the covers with his wife? Charlotte took a small bite of her sweet.
"Your expression is far from a resounding yes," Sherborne said, selecting a lavender cake and popping the whole treat into his mouth.
Part of Charlotte yearned to be courted, for the petty pleasure of flaunting Sherborne at all the nincompoops who had presumed she'd be delighted with their offers, at all the debutantes who'd spread unkind gossip about her, at all the matchmakers who'd regarded Charlotte as the sole reason their daughters hadn't taken, at all the Wyndhams who'd be surprised at her choice, and even a little worried. Especially at the Wyndhams.
"You shouldn't gobble the whole tea-cake at once," she said. "Take a genteel bite, Then put the rest back on your plate as you chew.
Genteel bites leave crumbs everywhere. Shall I court you, Miss Charlotte? I'm sure you could instruct me on the particulars.
Charlotte wanted to be courted, to be flirted with, to be given indulgent looks by married couples, while she earned envious sighs from the unmarried ladies. Such longings were foolish. She didn't love Sherborne, and he didn't love her. She'd be the only Wyndham in the history of Wyndhams who had failed to attract a love match.
"You shall not court me," Charlotte said. "Such a fuss would have no point."
Sherborne held up the plate of cakes for her again. She chose a slice of shortbread this time and got crumbs all over her lap while nibbling genteelly.
"The lady's wishes should be controlling," he said. "I'd enjoy squiring you about for a few weeks, but I applaud your pragmatism, too."
"Mr. Sherborne, what on earth are you—"
He kissed her,
a friendly smack on the lips. "A special license it shall be. I'll apply tomorrow."
"Mr. Sherborne, a special license will not in any way—"
He kissed her again, more lingeringly.
"Please, Charlotte, I'm not hopeless, and I will honestly try to make you happy."
Her inclination was to flounce away and leave him on the sofa, with a signature Charlotte Wyndham set down, a laugh, a wave, a witticism. But he was asking her to marry him, not flinging an offer at her as if she should be desperate to become his wife. Perhaps this was what her version of matrimony needed to look like, pragmatic, with an element of attraction, but no delusions, no flummery.
"I must have time to think about this," Charlotte said, "to think about the settlements."
She'd surprised him, which pleased her. She'd surprised herself. Mr. Sherborne was not the dashing swain of her fervent girlish dreams, but he fixed her tea the way she liked it, didn't put any value on small talk, and kissed intriguingly, even with the door open. He didn't strike Charlotte as the type to hover about his wife, though he would be very mindful of the finances. In short, he had possibilities. By the time Aunt Esther joined them 5 minutes later, claiming to have confused the day of her appointment, as if the Duchess of Morland couldn't keep the days of the week straight, Charlotte had decided only that she must have at least 3 days to consider Sherborne's proposal. 3 days was not long to ponder a decision that would affect Charlotte's entire future, but 4,320 minutes was an eternity to wait before she could sample another one of Sherborne's kisses. Sherborne suspected that the London newspaper had been invented so that men dining alone at their clubs had a fig leaf to drape across their pride. A fellow poring over the financial pages while consuming his steak could make the food, necessary for the life of every species, look like the afterthought crammed between more important undertakings. Sherborne refused to indulge such a fiction. A good steak was worth appreciating. Too many hard-working subjects of the Crown rarely had that privilege. He thus sat in unlordly splendour, alone at a table by the window, the passing scene on the street holding his interest between bites of fine English beef. The days were growing shorter, but the nights had yet to acquire a true chill. The thoroughfares of St. James's were thronged as the sun set and the mood of the neighbourhood shifted from work to play. Directly across the street were two discreet brothels, indistinguishable from their genteel neighbours, but for the volume of masculine foot traffic coming and going through their doors. Young men mostly, well-dressed and, based on their expressions as they emerged, well-pleasured. In a just world, the ladies would be well compensated for putting up with the young fools, though Sherborne knew from long experience that the world was not just.
"Good evening, Sherborne. Might I join you?"
Quinton, Earl of Brantford, pulled out the chair across from Sherborne.
"Presumptuous of me, but when Parliament sits, one must resort to desperate measures to avoid the politically impassioned."
A waiter was already crossing the room, cutlery for a second place setting in his hand.
"Brantford," Sherborne said, gesturing with his wine glass. "How flattering.
to be elevated to the status of a desperate measure. By all means, join me.
The waiter organized silver in a precise pattern on the linen tablecloth, then whisked a table napkin across Brantford's lap and poured his lordship a glass of the expensive vintage Sherborne had planned to savour over the next 2 hours.
"Humour makes so many situations more bearable,"
Brantford said, sipping his wine.
"That is decent potation, if I do say so myself."
Brantford had a title and means. His family seat was in the north, and his holdings included coal mines. Sherborne had made it a point to acquaint himself with aristocrats who held mining shares, or, like Brantford, owned mines outright. In recent weeks, Sherborne's status among proper society had shifted from politely excluded to cordially tolerated. Now an earl, albeit a presuming one, had singled Sherborne out for a shared public meal.
"The Duke of Morland favours that wine."
Morland had sponsored Sherborne's membership at this club, and dropping a ducal association into the conversation seemed prudent, though Sherborne had no idea how his grace preferred to wash down a steak.
"Morland's duchess has polished her former cavalry officer to a high shine," Brantford replied, "though she's had decades to do it. I hear you have some interesting commercial ventures in train over in Wales. I admire initiative in a man, or in a woman, for that matter."
Brantford smiled at his wine, as if recalling a lady of recent and intimate acquaintance. He was attractive, his blonde locks arranged a la Brutus, and his blue eyes complemented by a sapphire cravat pin. Sherborne sat back. The steak was overcooked, and signalled the waiter.
"Are you having a meal?" Sherborne asked. "Or was conversation your aim?"
Conversation that Brantford had turned to business with all the subtlety of a hound on the scent.
"I'll have the usual," Brantford said to the waiter. "A conversation is always part of a civilized meal. I know mining, Sherborne, while you're about to sink your first shaft. We can benefit each other, if you're amenable to taking on a partner."
The partner Sherborne wanted to take on, Charlotte Wyndham, had until the day after tomorrow to give him an answer to his proposal. If she agreed to marry him, settlements would require an immediate outflow of cash into the keeping of the lady's relatives. Had Sherborne so boldly broached a commercial matter, he'd have been labelled an encroaching mushroom, ill-mannered, grasping, and the death knell of a gentleman's reputation, not good ton. The same gauche overture from an earl was supposed to be flattering and admirably direct. Sherborne took a sip of hearty claret, the wine's smoky sweet notes lingering nicely. An investor who brought both funds and expertise to a business undertaking was worth considering, even if that investor did have a title and wore a waistcoat that made a nun look stylish by comparison.
"I'm willing to listen," Sherborne said, as the waiter placed a rare steak before his lordship. "But our discussion can wait for a more private setting."
Brantford took up his knife and fork.
"You must be joking. One's club is the holiest of holies, Sherborne. Why do you think the fashionable impure have set up shop across the street? No one in this establishment would dare mention who was seen paying them a call, much less who was in his cups or betting too heavily. Behind these walls discretion is assured."
Sherborne had it on the very best authority that discussing business in a social setting was inexcusably bad form. Charlotte could explain why a club wasn't a social setting, though all that transpired here was gossip and indolence.
"If I'm to take on an investor," Sherborne said, "then that individual will be privy to my ledgers, my budgets, my financial plans for the mine, right down to the last farthing. Anybody who'd discuss that level of detail where a competitor might lurk at the next table is a fool."
Brantford speared his steak, which swam in a pool of thick red juice.
"You come close to insulting your betters, Sherborne."
His tone was amused and chiding.
"You come close to disqualifying yourself as a possible business associate, Brantford. I will not sacrifice common sense for the sake of traditions I have little reason to trust." Brantford sliced off a bite of meat.
A modern sensibility, and one of which I approve, though not too loudly. Tell me about your mine.
The mine was still mostly sketches, estimates and schedules. Every geological indicator bodes well for good quality coal immediately beneath the surface. Now other mines operate in the valley, so finding labour should be easy, and we're close enough to the sea that transport of the product will be cheap.
Who's your engineer?
Hannibal Jones.
Good man, though you must be paying him a fortune to have enticed him away from Waxter.
Between bites of steak, Brantford continued his interrogation. His questions were intelligent and kept to the polite side of prying. From the nods and occasional greetings sent the Earl's way, Sherborne deduced that his lordship was well-liked and well-known. Though the aristocracy did not air their linen before outsiders, Brantford could have fought duels with half the men in the dining-room, and Sherborne would never hear a word about the contests, much less about any underlying provocation.
"So,"
Brantford said, helping himself to more wine,
"shall we engage in a bit of commerce, Sherborne? I'm casting about for new investments, and I can send my man of business around to have a look at those ledgers you mentioned."
"If you and I become involved in the same venture, I'll be dealing with you, not your toady. Intermediaries introduce delay and error, to say nothing of their own little agendas and schemes."
Sherborne's ambitions were tempered by pragmatism. He aspired to become accepted by polite society, which was not the same as included. To achieve his goal, he'd have to remain at least modestly wealthy, which his family had managed to do for a half-dozen generations. To ensure that his sons had a chance to continue that tradition, Sherborne could not afford a fool for an investor, no matter how well-connected or titled. Brantford set his plate aside, the steak only half finished. The dining room had filled with lesser titles, younger sons, and a smattering of old, quiet money. Sherborne was gradually putting names with faces, or with entries in Debrett's, but most of these men had likely gone to school with Brantford, or even now sat with him in the House of Lords. Why wasn't Brantford investing with one of them?
"Times change," Brantford said. "And you're right that subordinates are not always the most efficient means by which to accomplish a goal. You may bring the relevant documents."
Sherborne shook his head.
"I'm not hauling my confidential information all over Mayfair, like some tinker come to repair your pots. You have approached me about selling you an interest in a venture likely to be very profitable. The least you can do is take a stroll to my doorstep and pass an hour in my study."
An investor wasn't strictly necessary, but the right sleeping partner, as such an associate was termed, could create options, especially now when marriage settlements would reduce Sherborne's reserves. With an influx of capital, Sherborne could develop the mine more quickly. Other investors were more likely to contribute, and subsequent projects, for Sherborne always had subsequent projects, would benefit from the connections formed in the mining venture. Even so, Sherborne would not yoke himself to a simpleton, not for any amount of coin or goodwill.
"Where is your doorstep, Sherborne?"
He provided a direction several doors up from the Albany, the most prestigious lodging a bachelor could claim in London.
"Then perhaps next week I'll take that stroll."
Brantford filled his wine glass yet again, then shook the last drops, the dregs, into Sherborne's glass. A blatant gesture in the direction of "my cock is bigger than your cock," confirming once again that England was owned and run by a pack of overgrown schoolboys. Nonetheless, Sherborne had formed no particular opinion of Brantford as an individual, which was to say, he hadn't affixed to his lordship any of the labels that applied to most titled men of means: buffoon, parasite, idiot, disgrace to the species, hound, well-dressed incompetent. Though Brantford expected Sherborne to await a possible call on a day yet to be disclosed, on the slim chance that a business association might result, Sherborne simply lacked the humility to accommodate the Earl, so he provided Brantford instructions, much as Charlotte Wyndham would have.
"I'm a busy man, Brantford, with many demands upon my time. I haven't the luxury of idling about like some blushing debutante who hopes you'll get around to asking her for a minuet. I conduct business in a business-like manner, or not at all. You either make and keep an appointment with me, or you find yourself another project to grace with your coin."
Branford studied him, while laughter erupted from a table that included two earls, a baron, and a ducal heir. Sherborne hadn't raised his voice, hadn't attracted notice in any way, but he'd reached the limit of his manners.
"And that," Branford said, a slow smile breaking over his features, "is why your endeavours are notoriously profitable. Shall I come by Tuesday, 2 o'clock?
"Better. 2 o'clock will suit."
Branford rose and extended a hand.
"Until next we meet. A pleasure, Sherborne."
That gesture was as unexpected as Brentford's smile. Sherborne rose and shook hands, without smiling, but when he reached the street he did toss his hat into the air and catch it on the end of his walking stick. He had enormous work to do before he was accepted by polite society, but that achievement would come closer to fruition if an earl became involved in the mining venture. And if Sherborne were accepted, then his children might find themselves not merely tolerated, not simply accepted, but included among the best families in the realm, provided he could equip them with the right mother. Hour by hour, Charlotte was talking herself into accepting Lucas Sherborne's marriage proposal. He would provide well. His property marched with the Duke of Haverford's, meaning Charlotte would be neighbours with her sister Elizabeth. Sherborne wasn't stupid, arrogant, or idle, as Charlotte's previous suitors had been. She took another turn down the stable aisle, the horses eyeing her as they munched their hay. She could mail banknotes from any location, provided she had a little discreet assistance from a loyal staff.
"I'm not being entirely fair," she informed her Grace's bay gelding. "Mr. Sherborne is quite bright, confident without being an ass, and he brings a sense of energy with him, as some women wear a signature scent."
He was also attractive.
"Attractive,"
Charlotte admitted to her own chestnut mare,
"is not the same as handsome."
Handsome was commonplace. Every ballroom in Mayfair was full of handsome. Lucas Sherborne commanded attention. One wanted to know where he was, what he was about, because he was no respecter of meaningless conventions. His movements, thoughts, and decisions were unpredictable. Witness, he'd chosen Charlotte Wyndham for his bride.
"So you're visiting the stables in the grand Wyndham tradition?"
Her Grace of Morland, silhouetted in the stable doorway, cut a dash in a fine blue driving ensemble.
"Would you like to tour the park with me today?"
Sherborne wouldn't be caught dead gossiping under the maples at the fashionable hour.
"No, thank you, Aunt."
The Duchess stroked a gloved hand over the mare's nose.
"Are you avoiding anybody in particular, or the whole lot of them?"
"The whole lot. I have been taken into dislike by several of last season's unclaimed blossoms. I'm leaving them a clear field.
What do we know of Lucas Sherborne?"
"Come outside and we'll talk." Her Grace chose a bench in the sun, the afternoon light bearing that blend of mellowness and sharp contrast unique to early autumn.
"I have consulted with Aunt Arabella and a few of her friends, because Mr. Sherborne is something of a puzzle." "You read the history book, so to speak?"
The Duchess was clearly not surprised that Charlotte was curious. Would she be surprised if Charlotte became Mrs. Lucas Sherborne?
"When His Grace of Haverford put in a word for Mr. Sherborne, I decided some research was appropriate, and the tale is interesting. Mr. Sherborne's grandfather, Optimus Sherborne, was engaged to marry a daughter from the Haverford ducal line. She fell in love with another, and Optimus took the slight badly. He married a banker's daughter, became appallingly wealthy, and set about ruining the successor to the Haverford title.
His attempt at a feud failed," Charlotte said. "The St. David family thrives, and Haverford Castle is lovely."
If quaint. Elizabeth would soon have all in hand, though. "Optimus didn't expect to bring down a ducal family at one go," Aunt said. "He raised his son, Alcestis, to take over the task, and the present Mr. Sherborne was apparently brought up in the same tradition. Thank the good celestial ministers that Mr. Sherborne and Haverford have settled their differences. Some say the Sherbornes have a head for business. Others declare them vulgar and vengeful."
Lucas Sherborne was robust rather than vulgar, and Charlotte would never judge another person who had legitimate grounds for vengeance. Had she the means, she'd have wreaked vengeance on a settled, titled dandy years ago.
"What do you say about Mr. Sherborne, Aunt?"
Her Grace's driving habit was a soft periwinkle wool, the hems draping over smart black boots. She fussed with skirts that were tailored to arrange themselves into graceful folds, even while hanging in the wardrobe.
"Mr. Sherborne is not the average climbing sit," Aunt Esther said, "and you never were a marriage-mad henwit. Do you fancy him, Charlotte?"
"Yes."
"He doesn't put on airs. Your uncle wishes Mr. Sherborne wouldn't put on such remarkable waistcoats. I like those waistcoats. They remind me of our Scottish relations in their kilts. Only a confident man wears such noticeable attire."
A groom brought out Aunt Esther's phaeton from the coach-house.
"Only a confident man will do for you, Charlotte Wyndham. I've admired your fortitude, you know. Perhaps Mr. Sherborne is your reward for years of not settling for a nincompoop."
Charlotte rose to walk her aunt to the vehicle.
"When you say that word, it sounds so much more disgusted. I gather Uncle Percival wouldn't object to Mr. Sherborne paying me his addresses. His Grace would, of course, consult with your parents and with you, but he wouldn't call Sherborne out simply for having excellent taste as a suitor. Try not to overthink the situation, Charlotte. If you like Lucas Sherborne, then get to know him better and see what develops. Our menfolk will ensure that your settlements are handsome. You determine whether the fellow suits you."
Aunt patted Charlotte's shoulder and nimbly ascended to the bench. As the phaeton clattered out of the mews, Charlotte wandered across the alley into the back gardens of the Moorland townhouse. Aunt and uncle would reconcile themselves to Charlotte's interest in Lucas Sherborne, and thus Mama and Papa would too. This was good to know, for Charlotte didn't fancy battling all of the elders over her choice of husband. Though battle them she would, if she accepted Lucas Sherborne's proposal. The garden was going bedraggled about the edges. The chrysanthemums offered an occasional splash of purple, while the hedges were yellowing, the maple losing its leaves. The garden was tired, and so was Charlotte. Tired of a life without friends, without kisses, without a household of her own, the weariness alone would not have daunted her, but she was also bored and lonely, bored enough to consider daft schemes such as getting herself ruined.
What had she been thinking? He'll do.
Mr. Sherborne's kisses would more than do. The decision felt both bold and right. Right for Charlotte, if not for the typically romantically inclined Wyndham.
"Excuse me, miss, are you Charlotte Wyndham?"
A young woman stood at the garden gate close to the wall, as if she dared not set foot on private property. Her cloak was plain brown wool, and the unevenness of her hem suggested repeated mending. Her bonnet was a mere straw hat, no fancy ribbons or even a silk flower for adornment.
"I am Charlotte Wyndham. Who might you be?"
"My name is Miss Sharon Higgins. They said you'd help me."
Charlotte had been contemplating marriage to Lucas Sherborne with a combination of glee, anxiety, and excitement, for she had all but decided to accept his suit. Now this, another delicate situation arising without warning. Judging from Sharon's pallor, the situation was desperate as well as delicate. As such situations always were, though Charlotte hadn't been called upon to assist in this manner for months.
"When was the last time you had something to eat?" she asked.
"Yesterday, I think. Will you help me? They said you would."
They would have been the other maids, the laundresses, possibly a seamstress, or even the vicars at the humbler London churches.
Of course I will help you. You're eating for two now, so the first order of business is to find you some sustenance.
The woman wilted against the wall.
Thank you, miss. Thank you.
No tears, please,
Charlotte said, leading the way back across the alley.
We have much to discuss. Time is of the essence, and you'll need your wits about you.
Sharon cried anyway, and, as usual, Charlotte's wits were the only ones available to prevent what could all too easily become a tragedy. Chapter 4
Gold or silver? Turnbull held up two waistcoats, both heavily embroidered.
The sunlight streaming through the bedroom window revealed them for the works of sartorial art they were.
"I'm paying a courting call," Sherborne said, "though you are sworn to secrecy. I want to look like a man who can be trusted with the last prize in the Wyndham marital vault."
Turnbull said more with silence than most bishops could communicate in an entire sermon. On one occasion, when he'd been extremely disappointed with his employer, he'd turned in his notice. The memory still gave Sherborne nightmares.
"If you have to plunder treasure from a ducal family, where the gold? By all means the gold, sir. An earring wouldn't go amiss either, and a clean cutlass, no blood, though I venture to say that an eye patch might be a bit too much."
"Not the gold, then."
"If you were about to ask for Charlotte Wyndham's hand in marriage, which waistcoat would you wear?"
Turnbull returned both the silver and the gold to the wardrobe, and stood with his back to Sherborne while surveying the other possibilities. A Scottish marquis with military inclinations had come across Turnbull on a Caribbean island, bought his freedom, and taken him home to the Highlands. Either Turnbull had grown weary of the northern cold, or life as valet to the Scottish marquis had given him an appetite for challenges. Turnbull's wages were exorbitant, his knowledge of etiquette and fashion beyond price.
"This one," Turnbull said,
laying a rather dull choice across the bed.
"She'll be intrigued by the uncharacteristic subtlety."
And his scolds were exquisite.
"The embroidery has neither gold nor silver threads," Sherborne said. "It's boring. On a burgundy velvet waistcoat lined with black silk, I see purple, red, green, and white embroidery, with teasing dashes of yellow and orange. By your standards, it's a bouquet of gentlemanly understatement, and there's not another like it in all of London."
The pattern was a paisley intertwining of flowers, vines, and leaves, a bouquet in truth.
"You say there's not another like it in all of London? If the deity is merciful, there isn't another like it in all the world."
Turnbull would not allow Sherborne to go abroad in anything other than the first stare of fashion, despite his commentary on the occasional waistcoat.
"Fine, then. Subtlety for the suitor. I'll likely have to toss back the congratulatory tot with old Morland, and he wouldn't know a splendid waistcoat if his duchess modelled it for him."
That thought brought to mind Charlotte Wyndham wearing the gold waistcoat, and nothing else. Thank heavens she wasn't inclined to a tedious courtship.
"You are assured of the lady's acceptance?"
Turnbull held out a hand for Sherborne's dressing gown.
"As assured as any man can be, where the ladies are concerned. She likes me, but not too much. I respect her, and will provide for her as lavishly as her good taste allows. She'll bring connections and polish to the union, and I'll give her children, I think, a ruby for today's cravat pin. The biblical connotations are quite the clever association, if I do say so myself."
"She is more precious than rubies, and all the things thou canst desire cannot be compared unto her."
"No jewels when calling during daylight hours, sir. Will you make the young lady happy?" "I've promised her I'd try," Sherborne said, passing over the dressing gown. "But that's about as much of a swain as I can honestly be. Charlotte deals only in honesty, for which I'll doubtless worship her before our first anniversary."
When Sherborne had been dressed from top hat to toes,
He had to admit that Turnbull's suggestion, as always, had been perfect. I look like a sober London gent, until one takes a closer look. The waistcoat is subtle. You were right.
Thank you, sir.
And what flowers will have the honour of accompanying you on this most important call? The call was a formality, a gesture to Charlotte Wyndham's pride, though a gesture Sherborne was pleased to make. Demanding that he wait 3 days for an answer was her prerogative, one of few a lady could claim. Polite society loved its little rituals, and Sherborne loved the idea of marrying a duke's niece. He was also—this did not sit entirely well with him—fond of Charlotte, and more than fond of the fire she brought to even a brief kiss.
"I had hoped," Sherborne said, shifting the angle of his top hat, "that you, as the most competent valet in all of creation, would have the matter of flowers well in hand."
"If I were choosing the bouquet, I'd equip you with saffron," Turnbull said, holding out a pair of white kid gloves. "The message it symbolizes is beware of excess."
"Symbolism is involved. I have no patience with symbolism, Turnbull. I'm not philosopher, I'm a suitor."
"Snapdragons, then. Very colourful."
And likely very expensive, given the time of year. Sherborne pulled on his gloves.
"What do they symbolize?"
Turnbull closed the doors to the wardrobe with priestly solemnity.
"Presumption."
Turnbull was never wrong. With a single word he'd given Sherborne pause. Charlotte Wyndham was closely connected to three dukes. A brief review of her family tree also revealed a marquess's heir, four earls, and a smattering of courtesy lords. And Sherborne expected Charlotte to settle for a Welsh commoner?
"I do like the woman, rather a lot, and I'll be faithful and considerate. She'll never want for anything, and Charlotte's the managing type. She won't be bored with me."
Turnbull sighed, like a weary, disappointed godmother.
"I'll do my best, Turnbull."
"A bouquet of snowdrops, speedwell and jasmine awaits you in the foyer. Good luck, sir."
Coming from Turnbull, the good wishes were ominous. Sherborne straightened the angle of his hat and prepared to become an engaged man.
"Esther, refresh my memory. What does speedwell signify?"
Her Grace joined Percival at the window overlooking the front walkway.
"Fidelity. The snowdrops are for hope, and jasmine, if that's what Sherborne is carrying, is for grace and dignity. Presumably Charlotte's grace and dignity, and her suitor's fidelity and hope. A tasteful combination."
Love's handsome delight stood on the front steps, back to the doorway, as if taking a moment to rehearse a speech or a proposal.
"Young people today are so precipitous."
Esther kissed the Duke's cheek.
"Says the man who couldn't make it through a house party without offering for me. I hope Charlotte accepts him."
"If he is here to propose, then he's jolly well courting my wrath. I've heard not a word from Mr. Sherborne about paying his addresses, esteeming Charlotte greatly, and all that other folderol. Even I asked your papa's permission."
Esther gave him an amused look. Well, yes, he'd asked her father's permission after gaining Esther's notice, to put matters delicately, her intimate notice.
"I was an idiot," Percival said. "Charlotte is a sensible girl."
"Charlotte is not a girl, my dear. She's done it again."
Percival wasn't sure what it was, but he didn't care for the worry in his wife's eyes. He drew her down beside him on their cuddling couch.
"Done what? Cut her hair? I don't favour the mannish styles, but hair grows back."
"Percival, she's taken on another poor soul. I saw the whole business from my parlour window yesterday afternoon. I'd tooled away for a round of gossip in the park, but had forgotten my reticule. So I stopped out front and came back up here to remedy my error. A more bedraggled creature never set foot in our garden, and within the hour Charlotte's maid was off to return a book to the lending library."
"Oh, damn the luck."
"By way of a pawn shop?"
"Precisely.
Another pair of ear bobs, a bracelet, perhaps even a locket, sacrificed to buy coach fare for a complete stranger.
A complete stranger who was doubtless with child and without husband.
Charlotte's charitable impulses are nothing to be ashamed of.
The Duchess rose, and Percival remained sitting. Her Grace needed the whole of the parlour for pacing purposes when she was in a passion, and nothing confounded her more thoroughly than her sole remaining unmarried niece.
"Charlotte doesn't merely purchase them coach fare to whatever village they came from," Esther said. "She decks them out in widow's weeds, buys them a ring, manufactures letters from their supposed deceased spouses. I suspect the bulk of her spending money is cast upon the same waters, ensuring the same women have funds to raise their children. I'd commend her thoroughness, except that her scheme strays perilously far from traditional concepts of charity."
In other words, Charlotte didn't talk about helping the less fortunate. She took action.
"I can increase her allowance."
The Duchess whirled on her husband, her skirts nearly knocking over the hearthset.
"You most certainly cannot, Percival. She'll spend every penny on wayward laundresses or straying chambermaids. I would far rather you encourage Sherborne's suit."
"Charlotte deserves more than a preening Welsh nabob with a penchant for gaudy waistcoats. If more people had her ingenuity and practical sense of generosity, we'd not be hearing of corn riots and Luddites."
Esther took out a handkerchief and polished the base of the brass candlestick on the mantel.
"Do you recall Lord Hennessy's youngest boy?"
When the Duchess of Morland took to dusting, the topic was worrisome.
"The fair Adonis? Hard to forget a man cursed with such a name, even if he was a good-looking young devil. At one time I thought he'd earned Aunt Jenny's notice."
"Be glad he was nothing more than an aesthetic curiosity for Jenny. He got the Wapshot girl in trouble. Her mamma whisked her off to tour the great capitals, which everybody knew the Wapshot family could ill afford, and a child was born somewhere in the vicinity of Rome."
The Duchess had an intelligence network that beggared description. Decades in polite society resulted in a web of connections more complicated than even German royalty could fathom.
"Charlotte and Miss Wapshot were cordial, as I recall."
Charlotte hadn't made any real friends in recent years, but as a younger woman she'd been cordial to others near her age.
"Precisely," Her Grace replied, taking a swipe at a second candlestick. "Adonis was found in the mountains behind Carlton House, dead drunk, and wearing not one stitch of clothing. His curls had been shaven off, and his legendary physique was revealed to be a result of well-tailored padding."
"I recall the talk now, the hilarity. I hadn't known about the Wapshot's daughter."
That put a different light on what had appeared to be the sort of prank young men played on each other when they weren't waving dueling pistols about.
"Lady Hennessy was beside herself," the Duchess said,
rejoining her husband on the couch.
"A note had been tied about the young man's... tied where he was likely to find it. Provide for your offspring, or next time you'll wake up missing more than your curls."
Percival managed not to guffaw, barely.
"And did he?"
"Assuredly, though the young woman is still ruined, and always will be."
True enough, men were castigated for sowing wild oats, but suffered serious criticism only if they did so without providing for the resulting progeny.
"You suspect Charlotte had a hand in this mischief?"
"I know not how, but yes. The Wapshots have no sons, and Mr. Wapshot would never undertake such folly. Do you recall a Mr. Charles Oldman?"
Percival took his wife's hand.
"Banker's son. He was cutting a dash several years ago, though I haven't seen him about for the past few seasons."
"He got a maid with child. Charlotte shot his hat off his head at some archery tournament, and the hat, along with his hairpiece, landed at his hostess's feet. He acquired the nickname Bald Man."
"No more cutting a dash for Mr. Old Man.
Charlotte has devilish good aim."
"Charlotte has devilish poor sense. Viscount Deering got an arrow in the fundament at the last tournament Charlotte was invited to."
"Another chambermaid?"
"I did not inquire. but if I'm invited to a social gathering that includes an archery contest, I decline out of concern for the profligate rakes of proper society.
A truly proper society ought not to have profligate rakes, much less an abundance of them.
Why are you telling me these anecdotes now, Esther?
Percival inquired, not to accuse his wife of withholding intelligence, but because the Duchess had reasons for speaking and reasons for keeping silent.
I had hoped Charlotte was done being the conscience of Mayfair's randy bachelors. I haven't known her to take on a charitable project for months, and Arabella said Charlotte's behaviour at the summer house parties was exemplary for Charlotte.
You hoped to marry her off before her schemes came to light?
I still do.
Then we must wish Mr. Sherborne luck.
And courage, to go with the Speedwell and snowdrops in his bouquet.
"He's here, miss,"
Tansy said.
"Give your cheeks a pinch, and do try to let him finish his speech. Gentlemen set great store by their courting talk."
Tansy Luckett was Charlotte's lady's maid, and she looked honestly pleased to be sending Charlotte to greet Mr. Sherborne. Perhaps Tansy was tired of trips to the pawn shops.
"I'm not hopeless. Isn't much of a courting speech,"
Charlotte replied, though the other part, I will honestly try to make you happy, had haunted her. She checked her appearance in the mirror, hair in a tidy bun, dress reasonably free of wrinkles, smile nowhere in evidence.
"He's had 3 days to pretty up that sentiment,"
Tansy said, "though I've always admired a man who can get his point across with few words. You do look pale."
Charlotte had been up late, penning love letters from a man who didn't exist. She had managed a half-dozen progressively ardent epistles to Miss Higgins before falling asleep at her desk. Even the most sceptical parents ought to be convinced by Charlotte's prose, particularly when she'd also equipped the lady with a gold ring, widow's weeds, and £5 that dear Mr. Wesley had managed to put aside for his wife before he'd fallen so tragically ill, or been struck down by a runaway fishmonger's wagon. Mr. Wesley's various sad fates had all begun to blend together. £5 was a pittance to some, and yet the lordly bounder who'd got Sharon in an interesting condition had spared her exactly 2 shillings, and a warning never to contact him again.
"Mr. Sherborne brought you flowers,"
Tansy said.
"Roses?"
Red roses were the symbol of true love, though never had Charlotte been offered roses.
"Nothing so predictable. Go down and see for yourself. Best of luck, miss."
Tansy was small, but she packed a substantial push. Charlotte left the safety of her room and took a moment at the top of the steps to gather her resolve. If she married Lucas Sherborne, she'd remove with him to Wales, where she'd bide for months, if not years, before returning to London. From Wales, Charlotte could maintain her correspondence with the various Mrs. Wesleys, but where would London's unfortunates go for help if Charlotte left town? The foundling hospitals were a dodgy bet and usually full. The Magdalen houses were little more than an excuse to make a profit by working hopeless women to death. Nobody helped. Many sniffed and passed judgment. Even more took advantage of women who'd already been exploited. Some politely regretted the plight of gullible young ladies, but nobody helped. If Charlotte accepted Mr. Sherborne's proposal, she wouldn't be able to help any more either. She did not pinch her cheeks. What would be the point? By the time she reached the formal parlour, a maid was already wheeling a tea-cart down the corridor.
"We won't need the tea-tray, thank you," Charlotte said. "Mr. Sherborne's visit will be quite brief."
The maid bobbed a curtsy.
"Very good, miss."
Charlotte tried for a dignified gait as she entered the parlour, neither hurried nor reluctant. But she was no duchess, and she almost tripped on the carpet fringe.
"Mr. Sherborne, good day."
He stood by the window, the sunlight burnishing his blonde hair to gold. He was a Viking in Bond Street tailoring, and Charlotte was about to send him back to his longboat. Why must he be such an attractive Viking?
"Miss Wyndham."
His bow was correct, and his waistcoat quietly exquisite.
"Shall we be seated, sir?"
He gestured to the sofa, and Charlotte took a seat. He sat immediately beside her, not a decorous half-yard away.
"The butler stole my flowers. I suspect he's examining them for a torrid note. How are you?"
"In want of torrid notes.
A trifle anxious, to be honest. I'd like another kiss."
She'd like a lifetime of kisses where Sherborne was concerned, but she'd have to make do with two.
"Putting the cart before the horse, are we?"
"Putting the kiss before the discussion. That waistcoat is tastefully glorious."
He rose and held out a hand.
"Now I'm anxious. My valet told me you'd approve of my ensemble. I worry that he was right on several other counts."
Whatever that meant. Charlotte put her hand in Mr. Sherborne's and was drawn to her feet.
"I want a truly impressively, memorably torrid kiss."
"Inspecting what's on offer?"
"You are a who, not a what, and nobody has made any offers today. Please kiss me."
He frowned at her, as if she were a painting that hadn't quite turned out as the artist had intended.
"We should lock the door, my dear."
"I will never be your dear, more's the pity."
"You came bearing flowers? For that unprecedented act of bravery. We'll have a few minutes of privacy."
"Nobody sends you flowers?"
"Mr. Sherborne, do the words, please kiss me, exceed your comprehension?"
He smiled, and Charlotte stared at his cravat, a gold pin nestled among a wealth of blonde lace, with the smallest ruby winking from the depths. For a moment she wavered, not about the kiss, which she was determined to have, but about refusing his proposal. He had significant means, and as his wife, Charlotte might be able to aid many women, or she might be able to aid none at all. A wife was her husband's property, and if Lucas Sherborne disapproved of Charlotte's priorities, his word on the matter would be final. Then some friendless young woman, helpless and despondent, might die as a result of his whim.
"So solemn."
He drew his finger down the center of Charlotte's brow.
"So serious. One can't travel the distance from solemn to torrid in a single leap."
He touched his lips to hers and drew back a quarter inch.
"Now you."
She heeded his suggestion, for this would be the last, most torrid kiss of her life. She kissed him, her lips landing on the corner of his mouth, though that hadn't been her target. He waited, and she corrected her aim. He tasted of peppermints. Charlotte moved closer, the better to trace the curves and swirls of his waistcoat.
"When you do that," he muttered,
looping his arms around her shoulders. He kept a small distance between their bodies, which Charlotte took as evidence that he liked her hands on his torso. His heartbeat was a steady tattoo. When Charlotte teased her tongue along his lips, that rhythm might have accelerated. Her heart was certainly beating faster. Matters after that grew blurred. At some point Mr. Sherborne wrapped her in a snug embrace, which gave her permission to do the same with him. He was wonderfully solid in her arms, kissing her even as she pressed closer, and then he lifted her off her feet. He sat on the sofa with Charlotte in his lap, and a kiss that had been passionate turned consuming. Charlotte tasted him deeply, and if he hadn't been wearing so many blasted clothes, she might have lapped at him as a cat laps up cream. He did things, with his tongue, with his body, that shocked and delighted, and with his hands. His hands were a revelation. Where he touched her, Charlotte became sensitive, her face, her neck, her wrists. His caresses were confident and unhurried, which was the most breathtaking, maddening aspect of the whole encounter.
"I hate that I don't know how to...
He brushed her hair back.
"To arouse me?"
Arouse was another word Charlotte hadn't spoken aloud.
"Tease you, as you're teasing me. It's not fair."
She was cradled in his lap, the sofa's armrest supporting her back. The position was undignified, intimate, and far more comfortable than she'd imagined.
Simply walking across a room, you arouse me, Charlotte Wyndham.
He sounded no happier about that admission than Charlotte was to be refusing his proposal, for she would, any minute now. Before she made that sacrifice, she snuggled closer. Mr. Sherborne obliged her with a snuggle of his own. She had aroused him, and for a moment Charlotte grieved what could not be. Passion, affection, closeness that went beyond what Charlotte knew of sexual mechanics, to a sort of friendship she'd never envisioned. But then, what woman could imagine Lucas Sherborne? Charlotte would be imagining him for the rest of her life.
"I've decided not to marry you."
Mr. Sherborne went still.
"You do me great honour," she went on, for that was how this was done. "But we would not suit."
He set her aside, not roughly, but firmly.
"Of all women, I never took you for a hypocrite."
He was entitled to a fit of pique. He was not entitled to insult her.
"I am not a hypocrite. I meant what I said. I cannot marry you, and we would not suit."
She was lying, and she was telling the truth. He ran his hands through his hair, bringing order where Charlotte had sown chaos.
"We would suit like a lit taper suits tinder. You simply can't bear to marry a man who lacks a title."
"What?"
"I'm a commoner, and always will be. You can't reconcile yourself to marrying down."
Charlotte had braced herself for politely wounded male pride. Every unsuccessful suitor had had his pride, not for righteous indignation.
"My decision has nothing to do with a lack of title on your part. I am a commoner, as are all of my siblings and cousins save one, and he was born out of wedlock."
"Your siblings are titled, nonetheless, while I am a mere mister, not even an honourable."
And Charlotte was not her siblings.
"You are very honourable. If I were to marry anybody, it would be you. I'll see you out before either one of us says something regrettable."
Charlotte regretted turning him down. She did not regret kissing him. He rose.
"No need to see me out. I lack a title, but I do possess the ability to find the front door."
Charlotte got to her feet as well, lest he be seen stalking from the parlour in high dudgeon.
"Mr. Sherborne, I will accompany you to the door. You will bow over my hand, I will curtsy, and what has passed between us in this room will remain private. Women turn down proposals every day. We're fickle creatures, and our whims are of no moment."
He pulled on his gloves.
"You are neither fickle nor whimsical, and you don't turn down proposals every day."
"I turned them down nonetheless."
With appalling regularity. But he doubtless didn't offer proposals ever, and thus a frisson of guilt threaded through Charlotte's regret.
"I am sorry, Mr. Sherborne. Any woman would be lucky to have your esteem."
His perusal was brooding, but at least he wasn't dashing off in a temper.
"If you mean that, then why reject my suit? If some other man has a claim on your affections, I'll concede the field, of course. Otherwise, I'm prepared to be generous with the settlements. I'll be a decent and faithful husband, and you'll have a sister biding not a 30-minute stroll from our home."
He was genuinely perplexed, and Charlotte's heart was genuinely and very inconveniently breaking. Fidelity didn't characterize every marriage, or even most society marriages, but Lucas Sherborne would keep his vows.
"I wish you joy, Mr. Sherborne. Shall I see you to the door?"
"For a woman wishing me joy, you look like you're about to cry."
Why must he turn up perceptive now? Tears are soon dried.
"Charlotte?"
He was calm now. Worse than calm, he was focused. She'd become a puzzle for him to solve, and his scrutiny was more than Charlotte could bear. She cupped his cheek against her palm and went up on her toes to give him a farewell kiss. He held her hand with his own and kissed her back with a tenderness that tried Charlotte's resolve to the utmost. One more embrace, just one more. A breeze wafted past Charlotte as she bundled closer to the man she'd never marry.
"What on earth is afoot here?"
The Duchess of Morland's question cracked like thunder across Charlotte's awareness. For a moment she held on to Mr. Sherborne simply to remain upright. Sherborne stepped